It was the telephone that woke him up. Twilight had almost become night, and he made his way slowly past the glass-topped coffee table that liked to bite, with a weird feeling that time had somehow doubled back on itself. His right arm ached like hell. His back wasn't in much better shape. Exactly how hard had he swung that poker anyway? How much panic had been driving him? He didn't like to think. He picked up the telephone, not bothering to guess who it might be. Life has been so dreadfully busy lately, darling, that it might even be the president. Hello?
How you doing, Mr. Rainey? The voice asked,
and Mort recoiled, snatching the telephone away from his ear for a moment, as if it were a snake which had tried to bite. He returned it slowly.
I'm doing fine, Mr. Shooter, he said in a dry, spitless voice. How are you doing?
I'm a country fire,
Shooter allowed, speaking in that thick Cracker Barrel southern accent that was somehow as bald and staring as an unpainted barn standing all by itself in the middle of a field.
But I don't think you're really all that well. Stealing from another man, that don't seem to have ever bothered you none. Being caught up on, though, that seems to have given you the pure miseries.
What are you talking about? Shooter sounded faintly amused.
Well, I heard on the radio news that someone burned down your house. Your other house. And then when you come back down here, it sounded like you pitched a fit or something once you got into the house. Shouting, whacking on things. Or maybe it's just that successful writers like you throw tantrums when things don't go the way they expect. Is that it, maybe?
My God. He was here. He was. Mort found himself looking out the window, as if Shooter still might be out there, hiding in the bushes, perhaps, while he spoke to Mort on some sort of cordless telephone. Ridiculous, of course. The magazine with my story in it is on the way, he said. When it gets here, are you going to leave me alone? Shooter still sounded lazily amused.
There isn't any magazine with that story in it, Mr. Rainey. You and me, we know that. Not from 1980, there isn't. How could there be, when my story wasn't there for you to steal until 1982? God damn it, I did not steal your story. When I heard about your house, Shooter said, I went out and bought an Evening Express. They had a picture of what was left. Wasn't very much. Had a picture of your wife, too.
There was a long, thoughtful pause. Then Shooter said,
She's pretty.
He used the country pronunciation purposely, sarcastically.
Had an ugly son of a buck like you look into such a pretty wife, Mr. Rainey.
We're divorced, he said. I told you that. Maybe she discovered how ugly I was. Why don't we leave Amy out of this? It's between you and me. For the second time in 2 days, he realized he had answered the phone while he was only half awake and nearly defenseless. As a result, Shooter was in almost total control of the conversation. He was leading Mort by the nose, calling the shots.
Hang up, then.
But he couldn't. At least not yet.
Between you and me, is it?
Shooter asked.
Then I don't suppose you even mentioned me to anyone else.
What do you want? Tell me, what in the hell do you want?
You want the second reason I came. Is that it?
Yes.
I want you to write me a story, Shooter said calmly. I want you to write a story and put my name on it and then give it to me. You owe me that. Right is right, and fair is fair.
Mort stood in the hallway with the telephone clutched in his aching fist and a vein pulsing in the middle of his forehead. For a few moments, his rage was so total that he found himself buried alive inside it, and all he was capable of thinking was, so that's it, so that's it, so that's it, over and over again.
You there, Mr. Rainey?
Shooter asked in his calm, drawling voice.
The only thing I'll write for you, Mort said, his own voice slow and syrupy thick with rage, is your death warrant if you don't leave me alone.
You talk big, Pilgrim. Shooter said in the patient voice of a man explaining a simple problem to a stupid child. Because you know I can't put no hurting on you. If you had stolen my dog or my car, I could take your dog or car. I could do that just as easy as I broke your cat's neck. If you tried to stop me, I could put a hurting on you and take it anyway. But this is different. The goods I want are inside your head. You got the goods locked up, like they were inside a safe. Only I can't just blow off the door or torch open the back. I have to find me the combination, don't I? I don't know what you're talking about, Mort said. But the day you get a story out of me will be the day the Statue of Liberty wears a diaper, Pilgrim. Shooter said meditatively. Yeah, I'd leave her out of it if I could, but I'm starting to think you ain't going to leave me that option. All the spit in Mort's mouth was suddenly gone, leaving it dry and glassy and hot. What do you... Do you want to wake up from one of your stupid naps and find Amy nailed to your garbage bin? Shooter asked. Or turn on the radio some morning? Here she came off second best in a match with the chainsaw you keep in your garage up there. Or did the garage burn too? Watch what you say, Mort whispered. His wide eyes began to prickle with tears of rage and fear. You still have 2 days to think about it. I'd think about it real close, Mr. Rainey. I mean, I'd really hunker down over her if I were you. And I don't think I'd talk about this to anyone else. That'd be like standing out in a thunderstorm and tempting the lightning, divorced or not. I've got an idea you still have some feeling for that lady. It's time for you to grow up a little. You can't get away with it. Don't you realize that yet? I know what you did, and I ain't quitting until I get what's mine. You're crazy, Mort screamed. Good night, Mr. Rainey, Shooter said, and hung up. Mort stood there for a moment, the handset sinking away from his ear. Then he scooped up the bottom half of the princess-style telephone. He was on the verge of throwing the whole combination against the wall before he was able to get a hold of himself. He set it down again and took a dozen deep breaths, enough to make his head feel swimmy and light. Then he dialed Herb Creekmore's home telephone. Herb's lady friend, Dolores, picked it up on the second ring and called Herb to the telephone. Hi, Mort, Herb said. What's the story on the house? His voice moved away from the telephone's mouthpiece a little. Dolores, will you move that skillet to the back burner? Supper time in New York, Mort thought, and he wants me to know it. Well, what the hell? A maniac has just threatened to turn my wife into veal cutlets, but life has to go on, right? The house is gone, Mort said. The insurance will cover the loss, he paused. The monetary loss, anyway. I'm sorry, Herb said. Can I do anything? Well, not about the house, Mort said, but thanks for offering. About the story, though. What story is that, Mort? He felt his hand tightening down on the telephone's handset again and forced himself to loosen up. He doesn't know what the situation up here is. You have to remember that. The one my nutty friend is kicking sand about, he said, trying to maintain a tone which was light and mostly unconcerned. Sewing season. Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine? Oh, that, Herb said. Mort felt a jolt of fear. You didn't forget to call, did you? No, I called, Herb reassured him. I just forgot all about it for a minute. You losing your house and all. Well, what did they say? Don't worry about a thing. They're going to send a Xerox over to me by messenger tomorrow, and I'll send it right up to you by Federal Express. You'll have it by 10 o'clock day after tomorrow. For a moment, it seemed that all of his problems were solved. And he started to relax. Then he thought of the way Shooter's eyes had blazed. The way he had brought his face down until his forehead and Mort's were almost touching. He thought of the dry smell of cinnamon on Shooter's breath as he said, "You lie." A Xerox. He was by no means sure that Shooter would accept an original copy. But a Xerox. No, he said slowly. That's no good, Herb. No Xerox, no phone call from the editor. It has to be an original copy of the magazine. Well, that's a little tougher. They have their editorial offices in Manhattan, of course, but they store copies at their subscription offices in Pennsylvania. They only keep about 5 copies of each issue. That's really all they can afford to keep when you consider that EQMM has been publishing since 1941. They really aren't crazy about lending them out. Come on, Herb. You can find those magazines at yard sales and in half the small-town libraries in America. But never a complete run. Herb paused. Not even a phone call will do, huh? Are you telling me this guy is so paranoid he'd think he was talking to one of your thousands of stooges? From the background, do you want me to pour the wine, Herb? Herb spoke again with his mouth away from the phone. Hold on a couple of minutes, Dee. I'm holding up your dinner, Mort said. I'm sorry. It goes with the territory. Listen, Mort, be straight with me. Is this guy as crazy as he sounds? Is he dangerous? I don't think I'd talk about this to anyone else. That'd be like standing out in a thunderstorm and tempting the lightning. I don't think so, he said. But I want him off my back, Herb. He hesitated, searching for the right tone. I've spent the last half year or so walking through a shitstorm. This might be one thing I can do something about. I just want the doofus off my back. Okay, Herb said with sudden decision. I'll call Marianne Jaffrey over at EQMM. I've known her for a long time. If I ask her to ask the library curator, that's what they call a guy, honest, the library curator, to send us a copy of the June 1980-ish, she'll do it. Is it okay if I say you might have a story for them at some point in the future? Sure, Mort said, and thought, tell her it'll be under the name John Shooter, and almost laughed aloud. Good. She'll have the curator send it on to you Federal Express, direct from Pennsylvania. Just return it in good condition, or you'll have to find a replacement copy at one of those yard sales you were talking about. Is there any chance all this could happen by the day after tomorrow? Mort asked. He felt miserably sure that Herb would think he was crazy for even asking, and he surely must feel that Mort was making an awfully big mountain out of one small molehill. I think there's a very good chance, Herb said. I won't guarantee it, but I'll almost guarantee it. Thanks, Herb, Mort said with honest gratitude. You're swell. Ah, shucks, ma'am, Herb said, doing the bad John Wayne imitation of which he was so absurdly proud. Now go get your dinner and give Dolores a kiss for me. Herb was still in his John Wayne mode. To heck with that. I'll give her a kiss for me, Pilgrim. You talk big, Pilgrim. Mort felt such a spurt of horror and fear that he almost cried out aloud. Same word, same flat, staring drawl. Shooter had tapped his telephone line somehow, and no matter who Mort tried to call or what number he dialed, it was John Shooter who answered. Herb Creekmore had become just another one of his pen names, and... Mort, are you still there? He closed his eyes. Now that Herb had dispensed with the bogus John Wayne imitation, it was okay. It was just Herb again, and always had been. Herb, using that word, that had just been... what? Just another float in the parade of coincidences. Okay, sure, no problem. I'll just stand on the curb and watch it slide past. Why not? I've already watched half a dozen bigger ones go by. Right here, Herb, he said, opening his eyes. I was just trying to figure out how do I love thee. You know, counting the ways. You're a filly, Herb said, obviously pleased. And you're going to handle this carefully and prudently, right? Right. Then I think I'll go eat supper with the light of my life. That sounds like a good idea. Goodbye, Herb. And thanks. You're welcome. I'll try to make it the day after tomorrow. Dee says goodbye, too. If she wants to pour the wine, I bet she does, Mort said. And they both hung up laughing. As soon as he put the telephone back on its table, the fantasy came back. Shooter. He'd do the police in different voices. Of course, he was alone and it was dark, a condition which bred fantasies. Nevertheless, he did not believe, at least in his head, that John Shooter was either a supernatural being or a super criminal. If he had been the former, he would surely know that Morton Rainey had not committed plagiarism, at least not in that particular story. And if he had been the latter, he would have been off knocking over a bank or something, not farting around Western Maine trying to squeeze a short story out of a writer who made a lot more money from his novels. He started slowly back toward the living room, intending to go through to the study and try the word processor, when a thought, at least not that particular story, struck him and stopped him. What exactly did that mean? Not that particular story. Had he ever stolen someone else's work? For the first time since Shooter had turned up on his porch with his sheaf of pages, Mort considered this question seriously. A good many reviews of his books had suggested that he was not really an original writer, that most of his works consisted of twice-told tales. He remembered Amy reading a review of The Organ Grinder's Boy, which had first acknowledged the book's pace and readability, and then suggested a certain derivativeness in its plotting. She'd said, "So what? Don't these people know there are only about 5 really good stories, and writers just tell them over and over with different characters?" Mort himself believed there were at least 6 stories. Success, failure, love and loss, revenge, mistaken identity, the search for a higher power, be it God or the devil. He had told the first 4 over and over, obsessively. And now that he thought of it, sowing season embodied at least 3 of those ideas. But was that plagiarism? If it was, every novelist at work in the world would be guilty of the crime. Plagiarism, he decided, was outright theft, and he had never done it in his life. Never. Never, he said, and strode into his study with his head up and his eyes wide, like a warrior approaching the field of battle. And there he sat for the next 1 hour, and words he wrote none. His dry stint on the word processor convinced him that it might be a good idea to drink dinner instead of eat it. And he was on his 2nd bourbon and water when the telephone rang again. He approached it gingerly, suddenly wishing he had a phone answering machine after all. They did have at least 1 sterling quality. You could monitor incoming calls and separate friend from foe. He stood over it, irresolutely, thinking how much he disliked the sound modern telephones made. Once upon a time they had rung, jingled merrily even. Now they made a shrill, ululating noise that sounded like a migraine headache trying to happen. Well, are you going to pick it up or just stand here listening to it do that? I don't want to talk to him again. He scares me, and he infuriates me, and I don't know which feeling I dislike more. Maybe it's not him. Maybe it is. Listening to those 2 thoughts go around and around was even worse than listening to the warbling beep-yop of the phone. So he picked it up and said hello, gruffly, and it was, after all, no one more dangerous than his caretaker, Greg Carstairs. Greg asked the now familiar questions about the house, and Mort answered them all again, reflecting that explaining such an event was very similar to explaining a sudden death. If anything could get you over the shock, it was the constant repetition of the known facts. "Listen, Mort, I finally caught up with Tom Greenleaf late this afternoon," Greg said. And Mort thought Greg sounded a little funny, a little cautious. "He and Sonny Trotz were painting the Methodist Parish Hall." "Uh-huh. Did you speak to him about my buddy?" "Yeah, I did," Greg said. He sounded more cautious than ever. "Well?" There was a short pause. Then Greg said, "Tom thought you might have been mixed up on your days." "Mixed up on my... What do you mean?" "Well," Greg said apologetically, "he says he did swing down Lake Drive yesterday afternoon, and he did see you. He said he waved to you, and you waved back. But Mort..."
"What?"
But he was afraid he already knew what. "Tom says you were alone," Greg finished. For a long moment, Mort didn't say anything. He did not feel capable of saying anything. Greg didn't say anything either, giving him time to think. Tom Greenleaf, of course, was no spring chicken. He was Dave Newsom Sr. by at least 3 and perhaps as many as 6 years. But neither was he senile. "Jesus," Mort said at last. He spoke very softly. The truth was he felt a little winded. "My idea," Greg said diffidently, "was maybe Tom was the one who got a little mixed up. You know, he's not exactly a spring chicken," Mort finished. "I know it. But if there's anybody in Tashmore with a better eye for strangers than Tom, I don't know who it is. He's been remembering strangers all his life, Greg. That's one of the things caretakers do, right? He hesitated, then burst out. He looked at us. He looked right at both of us. Carefully. Speaking as if he were only joshing, Greg said, Are you sure you didn't just dream this fella, Mort? I hadn't even considered it, Mort said slowly. Until now. If none of this happened, and I'm running around telling people it did, I guess that would make me crazy. Oh, I don't think that at all, Greg said hastily. I do, Mort replied. He thought, but maybe that's what he really wants. To make people think you are crazy. And maybe in the end, to make what people think the truth. Oh, yes, right. And he partnered up with old Tom Greenleaf to do the job. In fact, it was probably Tom who went up to Derry and burned the house, while Shooter stayed down here and wasted the cat, right? Now think about it. Really think. Was he there? Was he really? So Mort thought about it. He thought about it harder than he had ever thought about anything in his life, harder even than he had thought about Amy and Ted, and what he should do about them after he had discovered them in bed together on that day in May. Had he hallucinated John Shooter? He thought again of the speed with which Shooter had grabbed him and thrown him against the side of the car. Greg.
I'm here, Mort.
Tom didn't see the car either? Old station wagon, Mississippi plates?
He says he didn't see a car on Lake Drive at all yesterday. Just you, standing up by the end of the path that goes down to the lake. He thought you were admiring the view.
Is it live, or is it Memorex? He kept coming back to the hard grip of Shooter's hands on his upper arms, the speed with which the man had thrown him against the car. You lie, Shooter had said. Mort had seen the rage chained in his eyes, and had smelled dry cinnamon on his breath. His hands. The pressure of his hands. Greg, hold the phone a sec.
Sure.
Mort put the receiver down and tried to roll up his shirt sleeves. He was not very successful because his hands were shaking badly. He unbuttoned the shirt instead, pulled it off, then held out his arms. At first he saw nothing. Then he rotated them outward as far as they would go, and there they were. Two yellowing bruises on the inside of each arm, just above the elbow. The marks made by John Shooter's thumbs when he grabbed him and threw him against the car. He suddenly thought he might understand and was afraid. Not for himself, though. For old Tom Greenleaf. He picked up the telephone. Greg.
I'm here.
Did Tom seem all right when you talked to him?
He was exhausted, Greg said promptly. Foolish old man has got no business crawling around in a scaffold and painting all day in a cold wind. Not at his age. He looked ready to fall into the nearest pile of leaves if he couldn't get to a bed in a hurry. I see what you're getting at, Mort, and I suppose that if he was tired enough, it could have slipped his mind, but no, that's not what I'm thinking about.
Are you sure exhaustion was all it was? Could he have been scared? Now there was a long, thinking silence at the other end of the line. Impatient though he was, Mort did not break it. He intended to allow Greg all the thinking time he needed.
He didn't seem himself, Greg said at last. He seemed distracted, off somehow. I chalked it up to plain old tiredness, but maybe that wasn't it, or not all of it.
Could he have been hiding something from you? This time the pause was not so long.
I don't know. He might have been. That's all I can say for sure, Mort. They're making me wish I'd talked to him longer and pressed him a little harder.
I think it might be a good idea if we went over to his place, Mort said. Now, it happened the way I told you, Greg. If Tom said something different, it could be because my friend scared the bejesus out of him. I'll meet you there.
Okay. Greg sounded worried all over again. But you know, Tom isn't the sort of man who'd scare easy. I'm sure that was true once. But Tom's 75 if he's a day. I think that the older you get, the easier to scare you get. Why don't I meet you there?
That sounds like a good idea. Mort hung up the telephone, poured the rest of his bourbon down the sink, and headed for Tom Greenleaf's house in the Buick. Greg was parked in the driveway when Mort arrived. Tom's scout was by the back door. Greg was wearing a flannel jacket with the collar turned up. The wind off the lake was keen enough to be uncomfortable.
"He's okay," he told Mort at once.
"How do you know?" They both spoke in low tones.
"I saw his scout, so I went to the back door. There's a note pinned there saying he had a hard day and went to bed early."
Greg grinned and shoved his long hair out of his face.
"It also says that if any of his regular people need him, they should call me."
"Is the note in his handwriting?"
"Yeah, big old man scrawl. I'd know it anywhere. I went around and looked in his bedroom window. He's in there. The window's shut, but it's a wonder he doesn't break the damn glass. He's snoring so loud. You want to check for yourself?"
Mort sighed and shook his head. "Something's wrong, Greg. Tom saw us. Both of us. The man got hot under the collar for a few minutes after Tom passed and grabbed me by the arms. I'm wearing his bruises. I'll show you if you want to see."
Greg shook his head. "I believe you. The more I think about it, the less I like the way he sounded when he said you were all by yourself when he saw you. There was something off about it. I'll talk to him again in the morning, or we can talk to him together if you want."
"That'd be good. What time?"
"Why not come down to the parish hall around 9:30? You'll have had 2-3 cups of coffee. You can't say boo to him before he's had his coffee. And we can get him down off that damn scaffolding for a while. Maybe save his life. Sound okay?"
"Yes."
Mort held out his hand.
"Sorry I got you out on a wild goose chase."
Greg shook his head. "No need to be. Something's not right here. I'm good and curious to find out what it is."
Mort got back into his Buick, and Greg slipped behind the wheel of his truck. They drove off in opposite directions, leaving the old man to his exhausted sleep. Mort himself did not sleep until almost 3 in the morning. He tossed and turned in the bedroom until the sheets were a battlefield and he could stand it no longer. Then he walked to the living room couch in a kind of daze. He barked his shins on the rogue coffee table, cursed in a monotone, lay down, adjusted the cushions behind his head, and fell almost immediately down a black hole. When he woke up at 8 o'clock the next morning, he thought he felt fine. He went right on thinking so until he swung his legs off the couch and sat up. Then a groan so loud it was almost a muted scream escaped him, and he could only sit for a moment, wishing he could hold his back, his knees, and his right arm all at the same time. The arm was the worst, so he settled for holding that. He had read someplace that people can accomplish almost supernatural acts of strength while in the grip of panic, that they feel nothing while lifting cars off trapped infants or strangling killer Dobermans with their bare hands, only realizing how badly they have strained their bodies after the tide of emotion has receded. Now he believed it. He had thrown open the door of the upstairs bathroom hard enough to pop one of the hinges. How hard had he swung the poker? Harder than he wanted to think about, according to the way his back and right arm felt this morning. Nor did he want to think what the damage up there might look like to a less inflamed eye. He did know that he was going to put the damage right himself, or as much of it as he could anyway. Mort thought Greg Carstairs must have some serious doubts about his sanity already, his protestations to the contrary notwithstanding. A look at the broken bathroom door, smashed shower stall door, and shattered medicine cabinet would do little to improve Greg's faith in his rationality. He remembered thinking that Shooter might be trying to make people believe he was crazy. The idea did not seem foolish at all, now that he examined it in the light of day. It seemed, if anything, more logical and believable than ever. But he had promised to meet Greg at the parish hall in 90 minutes, less than that now, to talk to Tom Greenleaf. Sitting here and counting his aches wasn't going to get him there. Mort forced himself to his feet and walked slowly through the house to the master bathroom. He turned the shower on hot enough to send up billows of steam, swallowed 3 aspirin, and climbed in. By the time he emerged, the aspirin had started its work, and he thought he could get through the day after all. It wouldn't be fun, and he might feel as if it had lasted several years by the time it was over, but he thought he could get through it. "This is the second day," he thought as he dressed. A little cramp of apprehension went through him. Tomorrow is his deadline. That made him think first of Amy, and then of Shooter, saying, "I'd leave her out of it if I could, but I'm starting to think you ain't going to leave me that option." The cramp returned. First the crazy son of a bitch had killed Bump, and then he had threatened Tom Greenleaf. Surely he must have threatened Tom Greenleaf. And Mort had come to realize it really was possible that Shooter could have torched the Derry house. He supposed he had known this all along and had simply not wanted to admit it to himself. Torching the house and getting rid of the magazine had been his main mission, of course. A man as crazy as Shooter simply wouldn't think of all the other copies of that magazine that were lying around. Such things would not be a part of a lunatic's worldview. And Bump? The cat was probably just an afterthought. Shooter got back, saw the cat on the stoop waiting to be let back in, saw that Mort was still sleeping, and killed the cat on a whim. Making a round trip to Derry that fast would have been tight, but it could have been done. It all made sense. And now he was threatening to involve Amy. I'll have to warn her, he thought, stuffing his shirt into the back of his pants. Call her up this morning and come totally clean. Handling the man myself is one thing. Standing by while a madman involves the only woman I've ever really loved in something she doesn't know anything about, that's something else. Yes. But first he would talk with Tom Greenleaf and get the truth out of him. Without Tom's corroboration of the fact that Shooter was really around and really dangerous, Mort's own behavior was going to look suspicious or nutty or both. Probably both. So, Tom first. But before he met Greg at the Methodist Parish Hall, he intended to stop in at Bowie's and have one of Gerda's famous bacon and cheese omelets. "An army marches on its stomach, Private Rainey. Right you are, sir." He went out to the front hallway, opened the little wooden box mounted on the wall over the telephone table, and felt for the Buick keys. The Buick keys weren't there. Frowning, he walked out into the kitchen. There they were, on the counter by the sink. He picked them up and bounced them thoughtfully on the palm of his hand. Hadn't he put them back in the box when he returned from his run to Tom's house last night? He tried to remember, and couldn't, not for sure. Dropping the keys into the box after returning home was such a habit that one drop-off blended in with another. If you ask a man who likes fried eggs what he had for breakfast 3 days ago, he can't remember. He assumes he had fried eggs because he has them so often, but he can't be sure. This was like that. He had come back tired, achy, and preoccupied. He just couldn't remember. But he didn't like it. He didn't like it at all. He went to the back door and opened it. There, lying on the porch board, was John Shooter's black hat with the round crown. Mort stood in the doorway looking at it, his car keys clutched in one hand with the brass key fob hanging down so it caught and reflected a shaft of morning sunlight. He could hear his heartbeat in his ears. It was beating slowly and deliberately. Some part of him had expected this. The hat was lying exactly where Shooter had left his manuscript, and beyond it, in the driveway, was his Buick. He had parked it around the corner when he returned last night. That he did remember. But now, it was here.
"What did you do?"
Mort Rainey screamed suddenly into the morning sunshine, and the birds which had been twittering unconcernedly away in the trees fell suddenly silent.
"What in God's name did you do?"
But if Shooter was there, watching him, he made no reply. Perhaps he felt that Mort would find out what he had done soon enough. The Buick's ashtray was pulled open, and there were two cigarette butts in it. They were unfiltered. Mort picked one of them out with his fingernails, his face contorted into a grimace of distaste. Sure, it would be a Pall Mall, Shooter's brand. It was. He turned the key and the engine started at once. Mort hadn't heard it ticking and popping when he came out, but it started as if it were warm all the same. Shooter's hat was now in the trunk. Mort had picked it up with the same distaste he had shown for the cigarette butt, putting only enough of his fingers in the brim to get a grip on it. There had been nothing under it, and nothing inside it but a very old sweat-stained inner band. It had some other smell, however, one which was sharper and more acrid than sweat. It was a smell which Mort recognized in some vague way, but could not place. Perhaps it would come to him. He put the hat in the back seat, then remembered he would be seeing Greg and Tom in a little less than an hour. He wasn't sure he wanted them to see the hat. He didn't know exactly why he felt that way. But this morning it seemed safer to follow his instincts than to question them. So he put the hat in the trunk and set off for town. He passed Tom's house again on the way to Bowie's. The scout was no longer in the driveway. For a moment this made Mort feel nervous, and then he decided it was a good sign, not a bad one. Tom must have already started his day's work. Or he might have gone to Bowie's himself. Tom was a widower, and he ate a lot of his meals at the lunch counter in the general store. Most of the Tashmore Public Works Department was at the counter, drinking coffee and talking about the upcoming deer season. But Tom was dead. He's dead. Shooter killed him, and guess whose car he used? Not among them.
Mort Rainey!
Gerda Bowie greeted him in her usual hoarse bleacher creature shout. She was a tall woman with masses of frizzy chestnut hair and a great rounded bosom.
Ain't seen you in a coon's age writing any good books lately?
Trying, Mort said. You wouldn't make me one of your special omelets, would you?
Shit no,
Gerda said and laughed to show she was only joking. The PW guys in their olive drab coveralls laughed right along with her. Mort wished briefly for a great big gun, like the one Dirty Harry wore under his tweed sports coat. Boom, bang, blam, and maybe they could have a little order around here.
Coming right up, Mort.
Thanks. When she delivered it, along with the toast, coffee, and OJ, she said in a lower voice, I heard about your divorce. Sorry. He lifted the mug of coffee to his lips with a hand that was almost steady. Thanks, Gerda.
Are you taking care of yourself?
Well, trying.
Because you look a little peaky.
It's hard work getting to sleep some nights. I guess I'm not used to the quiet yet.
Bullshit. It's sleeping alone you're not used to. But a man doesn't have to sleep alone forever, Mort, just because his woman doesn't know a good thing when she has it. I hope you don't mind me talking to you this way.
Not at all, Mort said. But he did. He thought Gerda Bowie made a shitty Ann Landers.
But you're the only famous writer this town has got.
Probably just as well. She laughed and tweaked his ear. Mort wondered briefly what she would say, what the big men in the olive drab coveralls would say if he were to bite the hand that tweaked him. He was a little shocked at how powerfully attractive the idea was. Were they all talking about him and Amy? Some saying she didn't know a good thing when she had it. Others saying the poor woman finally got tired of living with a crazy man and decided to get out. None of them knowing what the fuck they were talking about. Or what he and Amy had been about when they had been good. Of course they were, he thought tiredly. That's what people were best at. Big talk about people whose names they saw in the newspapers. He looked down at his omelet and didn't want it. He dug in just the same, however, and managed to shovel most of it down his throat. It was still going to be a long day. Gerda Bowie's opinions on his looks and his love life wouldn't change that. When he finished, paid for breakfast and a paper, and left the store, the public works crews had decamped en masse 5 minutes before him, one stopping just long enough to obtain an autograph for his niece who was having a birthday. It was 9:05. He sat behind the steering wheel long enough to check the paper for a story about the dairy house, and found one on page 3. Dairy fire inspectors report no leads in Rainey arson, the headline read. The story itself was less than half a column long. The last sentence read, Morton Rainey, known for such best-selling novels as The Organ Grinder's Boy and The Delacorte Family, could not be reached for comment, which meant that Amy hadn't given them the Tashmore number. Good deal. He'd thank her for that if he talked to her later on. Tom Greenleaf came first. It would be almost 20 past the hour by the time he reached the Methodist Parish Hall, close enough to 9:30. He put the Buick in gear and drove off. When he arrived at the parish hall, there was a single vehicle parked in the drive, an ancient Ford Bronco with a camper on the back and a sign reading, Sunny Trots, Painting, Caretaking, General Carpentry, on each of the doors. Mort saw Sonny himself, a short man of about 40 with no hair and merry eyes, on a scaffold.
He was painting in great sweeps while the boombox beside him played something Las Vegas-y by Ed Ames or Tom Jones, one of those fellows who sang with the top three buttons of their shirts undone anyway. "Hi, Sonny," Mort called. Sonny went on painting, sweeping back and forth in almost perfect rhythm as Ed Ames or whoever it was asked the musical questions, "What is a man? What has he got?" They were questions Mort had asked himself a time or two, although without the horn section. "Sonny!" Sonny jerked. White paint flew from the end of his brush, and for an alarming moment, Mort thought he might actually topple off the scaffold. Then he caught one of the ropes, turned, and looked down. "Why, Mr. Rainey," he said, "you gave me a hell of a turn." For some reason, Mort thought of the doorknob in Disney's Alice in Wonderland and had to suppress a violent bray of laughter. "Mr. Rainey, you okay?" "Yes." Mort swallowed crooked. It was a trick he had learned in parochial school about 1,000 years ago and was the only foolproof way to keep from laughing he had ever found. Like most good tricks that worked, it hurt. "Well, I thought you were going to fall off." "Not me," Sonny said with a laugh of his own. He killed the voice coming from the boombox as it set off on a fresh voyage of emotion. "Tom might fall off, maybe, but not me." "Where is Tom?" Mort asked. "I wanted to talk to him." "You know, he called early and said he couldn't make it today. I told him that was okay. There wasn't enough work for both of us anyways." Sonny looked down upon Mort confidentially. "There is, of course, but Tom ladled too much onto his plate this time. This ain't no job for an older fella. He said he was all bound up in his back. Must be, too. Didn't sound like himself at all." "What time was that?" Mort asked, trying hard to sound casual. "Early," Sonny said. 6 or so. I was just about to step into the old shitatorium for my morning constitutional. Awful regular I am." Sonny sounded extremely proud of this. "Of course, Tom, he knows what time I rise and commence my doings." "But he didn't sound so good." "Nope, not like himself at all." Sonny paused, frowning. He looked as if he was trying very hard to remember something. Then he gave a little shrug and went on. "The wind off the lake was fierce yesterday. Probably took a cold. But Tommy's iron. Give him a day or two and he'll be fine. I worry more about him getting preoccupated and walking the plank." Sonny indicated the floor of the scaffold with his brush, sending a riffle of white drops marching up the boards past his shoes. "Can I do anything for you, Mr. Rainey?" "No," Mort said. There was a dull ball of dread, like a piece of crumpled canvas under his heart. "Have you seen Greg, by the way?"
"Greg Carstairs?"
"Yes."
"Not this morning. Of course, he deals with the carriage trade."
Sonny laughed.
"Rises later than the rest of us, he does."
"Well, I thought he was going to come by and see Tom, too," Mort said. "Do you mind if I wait a little? He might show up."
"Be my guest," Sonny said. "You mind the music?"
"Not at all."
"You can get some Wowzer tapes off the TV these days. All you got to do is give him your MasterCard number. Don't even have to pay for the call. It's an 800 number.
He bent toward the boom box, then looked earnestly down at Mort.
"This is Roger Whittaker," he said in low and reverent tones.
"Oh." Sonny pushed play. Roger Whittaker told them there were times, he was sure they knew, when he bit off more than he could chew. And that was also something Mort had done without the horn section. He strolled to the edge of the driveway and tapped absently at his shirt pocket. He was a little surprised to find that the old pack of L&Ms, now reduced to a single hardy survivor, was in there. He lit the last cigarette, wincing in anticipation of the harsh taste. But it wasn't bad. It had, in fact, almost no taste at all, as if the years had stolen it away. That's not the only thing the years have stolen. How true. Irrelevant, but true. He smoked and looked at the road. Now Roger Whittaker was telling him and Sonny that a ship lay loaded in the harbor, and that soon for England they would sail. Sonny Trott sang the last word of each line. No more, just the last word. Cars and trucks went back and forth on Route 23. Greg's Ford Ranger did not come. Mort pitched away his cigarette, looked at his watch, and saw it was 9:45. He understood that Greg, who was almost religiously punctual, was not coming either.
Shooter got them both.
Oh, bullshit, you don't know that.
Yes, I do. The hat, the car, the keys.
You're not just jumping to conclusions, you're leaping to them.
The hat, the car, the keys.
He turned and walked back toward the scaffold. I guess he forgot, he said. But Sonny didn't hear him. He was swaying back and forth, lost in the art of painting and the soul of Roger Whittaker. Mort got back into his car and drove away. Lost in his own thoughts, he never heard Sonny call after him. The music probably would have covered it anyway.
He arrived back at his house at 10:15, got out of the car and started for the house. Halfway there, he turned back and opened the trunk. The hat sat inside, black and final, a real toad in an imaginary garden. He picked it up, not being so choosy of how he handled it this time, slammed the trunk shut, and went into the house. He stood in the front hallway, not sure what he wanted to do next, and suddenly, for no reason at all, he put the hat on his head. He shuddered when he did it, the way a man will sometimes shudder after swallowing a mouthful of raw liquor. But the shudder passed, and the hat felt like quite a good fit, actually. He went slowly into the master bathroom, turned on the light, and positioned himself in front of the mirror. He almost burst out laughing. He looked like the man with the pitchfork in that Grant Wood painting, American Gothic. He looked like that even though the guy in the picture was bareheaded. The hat covered Mort's hair completely, as it had covered Shooter's. If Shooter had hair, that was yet to be determined, although Mort supposed he would know for sure the next time he saw him, since Mort now had his chapeau, and just touched the tops of his ears. It was pretty funny. A scream, in fact. Then the restless voice in his mind asked, "Why'd you put it on? Who'd you think you'd look like? Him?" And the laughter died. Why had he put the hat on in the first place? "He wanted you to," the restless voice said quietly. "Yes, but why? Why would Shooter want Mort to put on his hat?" "Maybe he wants you to." "Yes?" He prompted the restless voice again. "Wants me to what?" He thought the voice had gone away and was reaching for the light switch when it spoke again. "To get confused," it said. The phone rang then, making him jump. He snatched the hat off guiltily, a little like a man who fears he might be caught trying on his wife's underwear, and went to answer it, thinking it would be Greg, and it would turn out Tom was at Greg's house. Yes, of course. That was what had happened. Tom had called Greg, had told him about Shooter and Shooter's threats, and Greg had taken the old man to his place, to protect him. It made such perfect sense that Mort couldn't believe he hadn't thought of it before. Except it wasn't Greg. It was Herb Creekmore. "Everything's arranged," Herb said cheerfully. "Marianne came through for me. She's a peach." "Marianne?" Mort asked stupidly. "Marianne Jaffrey at EQMM," Herb said. "EQMM, sewing season, June 1980. You understand these things, Buona." "Oh," Mort said. "Oh, good. Thanks, Herb. Is it for sure?" "Yep, you'll have it tomorrow. The actual magazine, not just a Xerox of the story. It's coming up from PA, Federal Express." "Have you heard anything else from Mr. Shooter?" "Not yet," Mort said, looking down at the black hat in his hand. He could still smell the odd, evocative aroma it held. "Well, no news is good news, they say. Did you talk to the local law?" Had he promised Herb he would do that? Mort couldn't remember for sure, but he might have. Best to play safe, anyway. Yes, old Dave Newsom didn't exactly burst a gasket. He thought the guy was probably just playing games. It was downright nasty to lie to Herb, especially after Herb had done him such a favor. But what sense would it make to tell him the truth? It was too crazy, too complicated. "Well, you passed it along. I think that's important, Mort. I really do." "Yes." "Anything else?" "No, but thanks a million for this. You saved my life." And maybe, he thought, that wasn't just a figure of speech. "My pleasure. Remember that in small towns, FedEx usually delivers right to the local post office, okay?" "Yeah." "How's the new book coming? I've really been wanting to ask." "Great," Mort cried heartily. "Well, good. Get this guy off your back and turn to it. Work has saved many a better man than you or me, Mort." "I know." "Best to your lady." "Thanks. Best to..." Herb stopped abruptly, and Mort could almost see him biting his lip. Separations were hard to get used to. Amputees kept feeling the foot which was no longer there, they said. "To you," he finished.
I got it, Mort said. Take care, Herbert. He walked slowly out to the deck and looked down at the lake. There were no boats on it today. I'm one step up. No matter what else happens, I can show the man the goddamn magazine. It may not tame him, but then again it may. He's crazy, after all, and you never know what people from the fabled tribe of the crazy folks will or won't do. That is their dubious charm. Anything is possible. It was even possible that Greg was at home, after all, he thought. He might have forgotten their meeting at the parish hall, or something totally unrelated to this business might have come up. Feeling suddenly hopeful, Mort went to the telephone and dialed Greg's number. The phone was on the third ring when he remembered Greg saying the week before that his wife and kids were going to spend some time at his in-laws. Megan starts school next year, and it'll be harder for them to get away, he'd said. So Greg had been alone, the hat. Like Tom Greenleaf, the car. The young husband and the old widower, the key. And how does it work? Why, as simple as ordering a Roger Whittaker tape off the TV. Shooter goes to Tom Greenleaf's house, but not in his station wagon. Oh, no, that would be too much like advertising. He leaves his car parked in Mort Rainey's driveway, or maybe around the side of the house. He goes to Tom's in the Buick, forces Tom to call Greg, probably gets Greg out of bed, but Greg has got Tom on his mind and comes in a hurry. Then Shooter forces Tom to call Sonny Trotz and tell Sonny he doesn't feel well enough to come to work. Shooter puts a screwdriver against old Tom's jugular and suggests that if Tom doesn't make it good, he'll be one sorry old coot. And Tom makes it good enough, although even Sonny, not too bright and just out of bed, realizes that Tom doesn't sound like himself at all. Shooter uses the screwdriver on Tom. And when Greg Carstairs arrives, he uses the screwdriver or something like it on him. And you've gone shit out of your mind. This is just a bad case of the screaming memes, and that's all. Repeat, that is all. That was reasonable. But it didn't convince him. It wasn't a Chesterfield. It didn't satisfy. Mort walked rapidly through the downstairs part of the house, tugging and twirling at his hair. What about the trucks? Tom's Scout, Greg's Ranger. Add the Buick and you're thinking about three vehicles here, four if you count in Shooter's Ford wagon, and Shooter is just one man. He didn't know, but he knew that enough was enough. When he arrived at the telephone again, he pulled the phone book out of its drawer and started looking for the town constable's number. He stopped abruptly. One of those vehicles was the Buick. My Buick. He put the telephone down slowly. He tried to think of a way Shooter could have handled all of the vehicles. Nothing came. It was like sitting in front of the word processor when you were tapped for ideas. You got nothing but a blank screen. But he did know he didn't want to call Dave Newsom. Not yet. He was walking away from the telephone, headed toward no place in particular, when it rang. It was Shooter.
Go to where we met the other day, Shooter said. Walk down the path a little way. You impress me as a man who thinks the way old folks chew their food, Mr. Rainey. But I'm willing to give you all the time you need. I'll call back late this afternoon. Anybody you call between now and then is your responsibility. What did you do? He asked again. This time his voice was robbed of all force, little more than a whisper. What in the world did you do? But there was only a deadline.
He walked up to the place where the path and the road came together, the place where he had been talking to Shooter when Tom Greenleaf had had the misfortune to see them. For some reason, he didn't like the idea of driving the Buick. The bushes on either side of the path were beaten down and skinned-looking, making a rough path. He walked jerkily down this path, knowing what he would find in the first good-sized copse of trees he came to. And he did find it. It was Tom Greenleaf's Scout. Both men were inside. Greg Carstairs was sitting behind the wheel with his head thrown back and a screwdriver, a Phillips this time, buried up to the hilt in his forehead, above his right eye. The screwdriver had come from a cupboard in the pantry of Mort's house. The red plastic handle was badly chipped and impossible not to recognize. Tom Greenleaf was in the back seat with a hatchet planted in the top of his head. His eyes were open, dried brains had trickled down around his ears. Written along the hatchet's ash handle in faded but still legible red letters was one word, Rainy. It had come from the tool shed. Mort stood silently. A chickadee called. A woodpecker used a hollow tree to send Morse code. A freshening breeze was producing whitecaps on the lake. The water was a dark cobalt today, and the whitecaps made a pretty contrast. There was a rustling sound behind him. Mort wheeled around so fast he almost fell, would have fallen if he had not had the scout to lean against. It wasn't Shooter. It was a squirrel. It looked down at him with bright hate from where it was frozen halfway up the trunk of a maple which blazed with red fall fire. Mort waited for his galloping heart to slow. He waited for the squirrel to dash up the tree. His heart did. The squirrel did not. He killed them both, he said at last, speaking to the squirrel. He went to Tom's in my Buick. Then he went to Greg's in Tom's scout with Tom driving. He killed Greg. Then he had Tom drive down here and killed him. He used my tools to do both of them. Then he walked back to Tom's house. Or maybe he jogged. He looks rugged enough to have jogged. Sonny didn't think Tom sounded like himself, and I know why. By the time Sonny got that call, the sun was getting ready to come up, and Tom was already dead. It was Shooter, imitating Tom. And it was probably easy. From the way Sonny had his music cranked this morning, he's a little deaf anyway. Once he was done with Sonny Trots, he got in my Buick again and drove it back to the house. Greg's Ranger is still parked in his own driveway, where it's been all along. And that's how the squirrel scurried up the trunk and disappeared into the blazing red leaves. That's how it worked, Mort finished dully. Suddenly his legs felt watery. He took two steps back up the path, thought of Tom Greenleaf's brain drying on his cheeks, and his legs just gave up. He fell down, and the world swam away for a while.